We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
In for Alex Downer. My name is Chris Whittingham on 560 WQAM. I'll be here until 10 p.m. this evening. Once again, congratulations to Alex and his lovely wife, gave birth to a child, Luca Giancarlo Dano. Just a fantastic name. Very jealous. Yeah, it's a soccer name, and it's just so Italian. Luca, for me, is a brilliant name. You have that go-between between Lucas and Luca. This the hanging A. Love a hanging A. So I'll be here. Discover and discuss a variety of sporting topics over the course of the next 2 hours and perhaps some other stuff. I've been very into the Oscars as we are building up to the Oscars on Sunday. I have not watched a great deal of the movies, but I'm just generally fascinated by Get Out and how Get Out as a horror movie is kind of making a run here for Best Picture. That's plus 550, I think, in the odds behind Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, and The Shape of Water. So it's third favorite right now to win Best Picture. And after last year when Moonlight won, you can kind of comfortably say now that, you know, we're going outside the box in terms of the movies that can win Best Picture. Then you have Jordan Peele, who can win for director and can win for Best Original Screenplay as well. And it's a horror movie and was produced by a horror studio that would never even dream of having Oscar nominations. This isn't a movie that's made for the Oscars. It's one of the reasons why the Oscars generally is not represented a sort of wide swath of America, is because they kind of go for a very, you know, typical structure of a movie that actually can win those awards. You don't see very many comedies. You don't see very many blockbusters like superhero movies get nominated. You don't see too many, you know, anything outside of really the drama genre get nominated. And so for Get Out, because it made such a cultural impact because it was such a rich and incredible movie. Now, of course, I'm arriving at the Get Out train, I don't know, about 9 months late. Came out February last year. I watched it, I think, late November, maybe, and it's kind of been stuck in my mind ever since, and now there's all this buzz about it, you know, potentially winning an Oscar. So maybe we'll talk some Oscars coming up over the course of the 2 hours. Right now, my televisions, a Warriors game is about to be played against the Washington Wizards. That's not what's catching my eye. What's catching my eye is on the other television is we are on, it would seem to be like this is a season premiere episode of Survivor. And I'm going to look it up right now. How many seasons of Survivor have there been? It's just an insane amount of television. The series debuted in 2001. We are on to season 35. They do two of these a year. I believe they tape them at the same time. So once the first one ends, they go straight on to the second one. And we're doing 35 seasons of Survivor? Now listen, I'll be honest. I got into Survivor fairly late in the ball game. When I think the first season I watched is because they put Jimmy Johnson on the show. And that was like one of the first times they kind of really went for a famous person. Then they kind of went for Jeff Kent. You'll recall that David Sampson was on the show. And so these kind of cameo appearances got me to watch. And I really enjoyed probably the two seasons that I watched. But I'm just amazed. They're probably like, you know, day one lifers of people that are watching Survivor. 35 seasons. Started in 2000, 2001, and that is where we are at the moment. So just, you know, something that caught my eye. But obviously, the sporting topic that I imagine has been discussed for the entirety of the day. That's right. I was going to have Ira Winderman on. I probably should have told you, Manny. I scheduled this. That is my apologies. Ira Winderman is joining us on the Toyota of Hollywood Hotline.
I was enjoying the Oscars talk and actually saw a few of the movies. So
I am a poor planner. That's my fault. what have you seen so far, Ira?
Excuse me?
What have you seen so far?
I saw three billboards and a couple of others with my wife this year, but I'm really curious because three billboards was sort of such a solemn message, but the acting was unbelievable in that. I mean,
yeah.
I think there's at least three acting nominations, including two supporting actors right there. Sam Rockwell, I believe, is the actor.
Yeah, and he's the heavy favorite to win, too.
He was so, so good in that.
Yeah.
And yet Woody Harrelson, who has always skeeved me out because he really takes extreme roles, but he did something in that movie, and I'm not being a spoiler if you haven't seen it, but where he was both unlikable and likable. I mean, that's sort of the range he has as an actor. He was terrific in that also.
Yeah, I saw that. So today I was listening to a podcast. They were kind of going through the odds,
mm-hmm.
and like there's three of the four categories that we just know already who is going to win. I think it's Gary Oldman for Best Actor. You mentioned... who is the guy that you just mentioned?
Sam Rockwell.
Yes, yes, Sam Rockwell and Allison Janney as well for I, Tonya.
Yes.
Apparently
yes.
She was terrific in that movie. So those are the main categories. But to me, the Get Out phenomenon is fascinating. We should talk about the Heat, though. I was going to get to it even before you called in, and I thank you for doing so. So Dwayne Wade, obviously, is the big talking point of this
sure.
one. And I was trying to come up with sort of the angle that no one has kind of come up with today, but I really think the only place that I can start is I did a podcast. You know, I've talked about this podcast before
sure.
with Ethan Skolnick and George Sedano today, comparing L.A. and Miami and how Kobe Bryant never left. And that will end up being the difference between Kobe Bryant and Dwayne Wade's careers. But you saw last night the emotional impact of having a player like him back, not just because he won the game. He wins the game with the deceased Stoneman Douglas student's name on his shoes. And you feel that connection between a community and a player. And yeah, we talk about all this other stuff when it comes to salary cap ramifications and building rosters and all this other stuff. But really, that connection is all that matters.
Yeah, and you know what also matters, though, is that this is being done in a winning context in a meaningful moment. This is not like Kobe Bryant's last season with the Lakers where, you know, he gets his 60 points in his final game, he has his moment, but, I mean, my gosh, even the last few seasons for the Lakers were so meaningless that even though they have that great following and they'll seemingly always love their Lakers more than the Clippers, for Dwayne to do it at a time where the game also mattered, where it also was in the middle of a playoff race, not just for the emotional moment of community and that young man who was killed in the Parkland shooting, but the fact is also that Dwayne is here doing meaningful basketball also, as well as meaningful community. That's the difference. The Kobe thing, you know, like you talked with George Sedano about, that was such a different experience. That would be like the Heat realizing they were going nowhere and telling Dwayne, okay, come back for a season, score a bunch of points, and then eventually after our draft trades are done, we'll get a lottery pick.
Yeah, and there is a difference between that, but I do think we have kind of reached a stage already. I didn't think it would be this quick where the Heat are relying on Dwayne Wade. And last night he delivered, but I'm sure you saw the stat from ESPN Stats and Info that in the last 10 seconds of a game,
right.
he hadn't hit a shot in that kind of scenario since 2012. And so do you think that we're now reaching the stage where it's over-reliance? He leads the team in usage rate since he's come back. They are relying on him at the end of games, and
I don't think it's by design. I think it's by deference. I think it's by players looking at the court and saying, oh my God, that's Dwayne Wade. He's going to the Hall of Fame. I'm not here. Take the ball. I think that's a coaching
situation. But why didn't that happen at his other destinations? Why didn't that happen in Chicago, and why didn't that happen in Cleveland?
Well, in Chicago, I think the case there was it just never fit. And remember, he was with Rondo. He was with Jimmy Butler. He was with bona fide ego stars. Like, that's the difference. The Heat had stars in Goran Dragic and to a lesser degree, Hassan Whiteside. But they're not ego stars. They're not feed me also. LeBron James and Kevin Love are those kind of players. In Chicago, Jimmy Butler and Rajon Rondo are those kind of players. That's the difference. These are a bunch of deferential players. Chris, I think it's really dangerous what's going on, which sounds weird after such an emotional moment we saw last night. But Goran Dragic can't keep giving the ball to Dwayne Wade, and the Heat can't keep deferring. No other player in the fourth quarter for the Heat took more than two shots. yes, it worked yesterday. That's all well and good. That's fine. You know, the last shot, second to last shot, I have no problem with that. But I think when you go back and look at the tape, the offense stopped moving. The players got a bit too deferential, and Dwayne had to do it the hard way. You know what? At 36 years old, you can't do it the hard way for the final 21 games of the season.
My question is why does that immediately change? Because, yes, you mentioned there's this deference, but without Dwayne Wade, they managed they've been actually pretty poor in close games of late, but yes. Over the course of the season, they've played a lot of them, have won more than they've lost. Why does the dynamic necessarily have to change? Why can't they just keep doing what they're doing with Dwayne Wade in the context of that offense? And, look, and this is, like you said, a difficult night to bring that point up, but I do think we are going to reach a stage where the Heat are going to keep playing close games, and it's going to keep end up being in the hands of Dwayne Wade. And I'm not sure if that is a plan for a team to make the playoffs.
No, I don't think it is, and I think Eric Spoelstra realizes that as well. And remember Josh Richardson with those, you know, those games and the scores he made at the end of the games, especially home against Milwaukee, and then Wayne Ellington's drive in the next game in Toronto, things like that. They have to stay with that. They have to have a variety, because if you're going to become single-based when you get into the playoffs, there's a lot better players than Dwayne Wade who are going to be closers, and probably every team the Heat faces in the playoffs will have a better closer. You know, that I've never been high on ensemble basketball as a playoff-winning style. I think sometimes singular players have to take over. I would try to prime Goran Dragic a little more for that. Chris, you remember the start of the season when Goran came off Eurobasket, and we really thought this was his breakthrough time. But then Deion Waiters was still in his way, and Deion Waiters wound up scoring pretty well. He had that moment where he single-handedly won a game in Utah. I think right now it's sort of a honeymoon period where the marriage got back together and everyone's living in the same house again. And I think this is when Eric Spoelstra has to go to work also. And he has to draw up plays, and it can't be just Dwayne dribbling around. But it also has to be the other players driving hard and cutting hard and setting hard screens and working those kind of plays also, or else they're in trouble. So I agree with you. This is a nice storyline for the moment. But this can't be the story of the 2017-2018 Miami Heat.
Ira Winderman is with us here on WQAM, and obviously, I almost feel like as a market correction, I should be more positive about this because, and frankly, I get labeled as a Dwayne Wade hater just because.
Really?
It's because I was pointing some of these things out, like in 2016, when I thought they were too, deferential. Then, when I remember a game where they had to, get a three at the end, and it's just no matter what at the end of game situations that the ball is going to be in his hands, and you look at his usage rate. I mean, 28% usage compares with the very best players in the NBA, and I just think that it's a pedigree thing that the Heat were never going to be able to shed as long as he's here. It's the same thing that happened with Kobe. Now, you mentioned the difference in the fact that they're playing games to win them right now. They're competing for a playoff spot, but I just think as long as he's in this uniform, that's not going to change. And to me, the other thing, too, is that Eric Spoelstra just implicitly trusts Dwayne Wade, and I don't think is really, going to shake this up in a meaningful way.
Well, I think someone has to tell Eric Spoelstra, which, and of course, he knows, this is 36-year-old Dwayne Wade. We all have the memories ingrained of those moments also. But, Chris, even at the end, I'm going to be honest with you. That last play, wasn't that to a degree so reminiscent of, remember when he used to almost dribble out the clock when they were behind by one? He'd be in those situations, and you're sitting there when he was here in 2015, the end of 2016, you're like, shoot the ball. Give the Heat a chance for a rebound. Make more out of the play. That's Dwayne's confidence. Look, they played in transition on that play, so that's a little different situation. But I think there have to be more sets to get everyone involved. I think what happened here, Chris, is Dwayne got the Heat out of the darkness, out of the abyss, out of those 8 losses in 9 games. They needed someone mentally stronger than they had in their team. But as they move forward, if they get the win tomorrow against the Lakers, if they do something good against the Pistons, and especially against the Suns next Monday, and the record becomes better and there's a little more playoff comfort for this team, I think that's when you have to be so careful if you're Eric Spoelstra that it doesn't become what you say, because you know what? There's still 2 back-to-backs left, and he's still 36 years old. And if you really are going to the playoffs, which it looks that way, you got to save the guy to a degree also.
Here's the other element that's sort of going to be creeping in as it relates specifically to tomorrow. It's more of a small picture thing than a big picture thing, is the injuries right now. Ellington and Tyler Johnson picking up kind of smaller injuries. How do you see the reshuffling of the rotation, particularly at shooting guard, heading into tomorrow night?
Well,
you think Wade
I mean,
even starts?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like we sort of went, like, you know, from couldn't happen to might happen to might have to happen. If right now the Heat are listing Ellington is doubtful. I think with his age, with the experience we have with his thigh contusion that kept him out for weeks at the start of last season, they're being careful. Even though there's a questionable with Tyler, I think they've got to be careful with him because he's like a human bruise every time he goes out there. So if you take those two out of the equation, I don't think there's easy answers. I don't think you can move Justice Winslow to the three and Josh Richardson to the two because I'm not so sure you would get enough spacing unless maybe you could start Kelly Olynyk, but then it gets dramatically different. Eric always likes to use a placeholder. So the question is, Rodney Magruder, after one game, is he your starter? Dwayne Wade, can you space it out so even though he starts, he only plays 6 minutes in each of the first three quarters so he has enough at the end? I just don't know about going with Dwayne as a starter because you know what? This sounds weird, Chris. What if it works? Aren't you sort of getting locked
yes.
in? You know, I know it's like
but that was my thing about him closing games and then winning games is that eventually you're just going to talk yourself into being the strategy.
Right, and that's the thing. And I think maybe Eric wants to avoid that. So maybe you move Justice down, you start James Johnson or something like that. The Lakers are good, not great. They're going through their own injury situations now. They're not tanking, though. That's the difference. They're playing to win because they lost their first-round pick anyway. So they're a little different than the other losing teams the Heat are going to play. But, yeah, I think if you were to ask me if both Tyler Johnson is out, unless they bring back like a Derrick Jones Jr., which would seem to be the thing to do, but I think he's down to like four games left in the NBA before they have to make a decision. That's what Eric Spoelstra would have done before Dwayne Wade got here. Without question, he would have started Derrick Jones Jr. I don't think you fly him in just for one or two games. So yeah, I probably say when you quote your betting odds for the Oscars, if you quoted them for the Heat, Dwayne is a starter if those two are out, might be the best bet.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the strategic decision to foul with 27 seconds left to play in a tie game. There were kind of, you know, obviously descriptions of the thinking behind that. Obviously, it ended up working in the end, but what did you make of it in the moment?
Well, in the moment, I thought it was pure coaching on Eric Spoelstra's part that we are going to win this game. They have a terrible free throw shooter out there, just over 50%. We're going to take our chances, and I had no issue with it. It's a thing that you heard Eric after the game. Goran Dragic spoke about it. In Europe, they do it all the time. If there's 24 seconds to go and the other team is going to have the ball with a chance to win or force overtime and you get a poor free throw shooter, you take that chance. That's what they do overseas. Let us try to win the game. Of course, what people forget is the counter could have been then, after Ben Simmons hits his free throw, is for the Sixers to go ahead and foul, take the time off the clock, and you keep going back and forth, and all of a sudden we're playing college basketball again. I like the strategy, though. I like the chance that I'd rather have the ball in my hands. Chris, it comes down to this and nothing else. Let's say 15 seconds to go in a game. Where would you rather be? In a tie game with the other team holding the ball or down one and you have the ball? That's basically the math that Eric Spoelstra and more his players went through. He didn't want the foul. He told them only if Dwayne doesn't make three free throws should you foul. But apparently, if you listen to both Goran Dragic and Dwayne Wade, they sort of decided unilaterally, no, we're going to foul and get the ball back in our hands. So let me ask you this. Which situation would you rather be in? Tie game, other team can win or force overtime, or else rather be down by one and have the ball with 10, 15 seconds to go?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I would probably, particularly because of the way that I think the Heat have been poor at the end of games,
right,
and don't really have offensive plays that they can lean on, other than, you know, Dwayne Wade 21-foot step back jumpers that he can make at the buzzer. I would probably lean towards try to defend and get the stop. That would be my personal preference.
And they've been very poor against that high pick and roll. I mean, you saw with Anthony Davis in New Orleans on Friday. You saw last night with Embiid playing off, you know, J.J. Redick. And I got to tell you something else, Chris, you know, because I know you watch and chart and look at every play. Think about this. If the Heat would have let it play out in a tie game, okay, the last shot that J.J. Redick got was as good of a shot as anyone could want in a tie game situation, let alone being down one, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't know if you had a chance to actually slow down and watch the replay, but I don't know what the heck Josh Richardson was thinking. He sunk into the lane so far away from one of the game's ultimately great three-point shooters that, I mean, you can call it a brain whatever you want, and he did it right there. But he really butchered that final possession. It's just the basketball fates were in their favor.
Yeah, and I think in that situation, you're over-defending to give up the easy one.
Yes.
But J.J. Redick, from anywhere on the floor, wide open, is an easy
wide
one.
Wide open, yeah.
And so you have one of the game's best shooters wide open. That was always going to be dangerous. One more thing before I let you go was Kelly Olynyk last night returning and playing well.
Mm-hmm.
He has an impact on winning when he's in the game. The Heat outscored the Sixers by 11, so it was plus 11 in terms of plus-minus. Have you been surprised? I thought that the Heat might end up regretting that signing. Of the major contracts they give out this offseason, that one looks by far the best.
Yeah, I mean, I say no. I say there were four contracts. Deion Waiters, when we find out now they knew about the ankle injury and still signed him, yes, real questionable. James Johnson, 31 years old, $60 million over 4 years, the bigger contract, questionable. The other contract, of course, was the four-year, $42 million deal for Josh Richardson, which I think will be an incredible value when that starts next season. So they have that also. But the Olynyk deal, $450 million, yeah, there were some questions. Chris, I got to tell you this, though. As well as it's played out now, he's a closer. He's a finisher. He's been terrific in fourth quarters, even if he had that one moment when he let Saric get to three last night. But I'm going to question you saying it's the best deal for this reason. If they cannot figure out the Whiteside Adebayo Olynyk conundrum, then I don't think any of those players will get enough money, get enough playing time to maximize who they are. That we're still at critical mass with that. Yes, last night Hassan Whiteside and Kelly Olynyk played together as finishers. It worked barely. If Redick hits a shot, maybe we're looking back at that. But look at Bam Adebayo's minutes last night. He played fewer than 7 minutes in the game. So is this your solution with Kelly Olynyk coming back? I know they went small. I know Embiid had five fouls early, and it was a different complexion. But to me, drafting Bam Adebayo in the first round at number 14, then signing Kelly Olynyk to a four-year, $50 million deal and still having Hassan on the roster – it's going to be a question going into this offseason also. That's almost wasted money. That's like having two really good quarterbacks or three really good goalies. You can only play them so many minutes.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. I just think just in terms of the impact that he's had, and like you said, you can run an end-of-game offense through him. I was not expecting for him to be this skilled of a player. Obviously, you watch him the two or three times he comes in with Boston, but, man, I've been totally surprised, and there is a bit of that redundancy, though. I think the Heat might have hit too much on that position just in terms of I don't know if they were prepared for Bam to be this good.
Right, and where the game is going, and everyone going small all the time. So now three are playing the four, and that's harder for someone like Bam or Kelly Olynyk to play also. They still have to sort through that. And the other problem is the closing lineup. When you have Dwayne Wade and Kelly Olynyk out there, as we saw in the pick and rolls, you're going to have defensive issues also. That's the flip side of Dwayne Wade. You're in a close game. You're opting for 36-year-old Dwayne Wade. I mean, Chris, you know what? You don't have to face him. You don't go in the locker room. So I'm going to put the question on you. How would you rate Dwayne Wade right now as a defender?
Not good.
I mean, like in a percentage of 100% is a great defender and 0% is a lousy defender, he's sort of like a 20 or 30 right now,
yeah.
Isn't he?
Yeah. Because I remember when he was here the last time, you know, and probably 2 years before we left, I was watching regular season 2014 games, and you just see him on the defensive end. It's economical. It's energy saving on the defensive end of the floor the entire game. Just I'm going to take a shortcut here and a shortcut there, and it's never full intensity, full effort.
Right, and there's moments. There's a chase down block at the end of the Milwaukee game, for example. He still creates his moments, and you still have that. And here's the other part of it, and this is really changed for people who watch basketball closely this year, the lack of timeouts. Remember, Chris, it always used to be offense, defense at the end of games. Coaches had a gazillion timeouts. They could stop the game whenever they want. Now you have a maximum of two in the last 2 minutes. You can't play offense, defense when the game is still going on. That leads to hard decisions, and Eric Spoelstra has told us by his actions, I'm going to play Dwayne in those situations. Well, you know what? Last night it wasn't that bad against Philadelphia when the opposing shooting guard is J.J. Redick, God bless him. But when they start playing those fiercely good shooting guards, and Dwayne has to be the defender of choice at the end of games to get his offense, I think that's when you're going to see issues, when they're going against the Raptors and he has to go against DeMar DeRozan because you have to make a choice. That's where it's going to get interesting. You're going to see that in a bunch of playoff matchups coming up, should they make it.
I do think, though, he ramps it up in the playoffs in terms of intensity, just because we saw, because I had the same kind of criticisms in 2016, and then they beat Charlotte, and he was, I thought, pretty good in that series defensively. Now, it's 2 years on, and, you know, that energy reservoir is not going to be at the same level, but I do think in the playoffs it gets marginally better. But yeah, these are important regular season games they have to win every night.
And no back-to-backs help also, and the spacing helps there also. So, quick, one last question on the way out.
Yeah.
So I'm playing the whole playoff watch game. I got my package on right now. Detroit's up 53-44 in Milwaukee at the half. Who do you root for there? Do you root for Detroit just to go away so the Heat just makes the playoffs? Or do you sit here and you say to yourself, you know what, Heat are playing pretty well. They won the season tiebreaker in Milwaukee. Let's try to move up. Who should Heat fan, for the next hour and a half you have on your show, who should they be rooting for in this game?
I would say on recent form, on the fact that they've lost more than they've won of late, I'd say you're looking down more than up. Now, okay. Detroit is three back in the loss column, so maybe you can afford to start to look up a little bit. But I'd say just in terms of the way that the games have gone recently, I'm looking more down than up.
No, and I agree. And that's why when I was watching this game, like Milwaukee being down 9 at half, you know, they're going to crawl closer. Charlotte's within 6 of Boston going into halftime. And the one that really bothers me is Atlanta right now is up 2 late in the second quarter against Indiana. But Chris, as you know, these tankathons always turn in the fourth quarter. That's when the coaches pulled anyone who could possibly score to make sure they could lose like Atlanta is. That's the toughest part for me with scoreboard watching right now.
Yeah, I was railing against it last night. You know, Toronto, Indiana, well, Memphis and Phoenix, that's going to make for comic viewing in terms of who's going to try and tank harder in that one. Oklahoma City, you know, over Dallas, like those are teams that you just know are going to win tonight. I mean, it's too much. There's too much incentive for these teams to lose.
You get your hopes up, and you go, "Wow, Atlanta's playing Indiana really well right now." But you know, at a certain point, Mike Budenholzer, the coach there, sort of has an edict. Don't you dare put your best foot forward late in the game. That's what makes some of this really hard to stomach, and that's why I know we're out of time, but that's why the whole tanking thing on your next podcast, when you get to it, really has to be addressed even more, because there is never, that I can recall, been a race to the bottom like this season.
Yep, 8 teams involved in it. It's absolutely insane. All right, Ira, appreciate the time.
Hey, appreciate the extra minutes. Now we go back to all Oscar talk all the time. Thanks, Chris.
That is Ira Winderman of the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I very much appreciate him taking the time and, frankly, remembering that he was going to come on, because I was just getting ready to yammer and, you know, because we worked it out on Monday. I didn't even tell our producer, Manny Cheng. We worked it out on Monday, and so I just totally forgot because I'm a terrible planner. More Heat Talk coming up next. To get off in this club, have me a good time. In for Alex Downing, my name is Chris Whittingham here on 560 WQAM. Our thanks to Ira Winderman for joining me in the previous segment. Talking plenty of Miami Heat basketball, and I think the Dwayne Wade thing is a fascinating one, because I'm ready to, you know, poke holes in it, but to critically analyze it. But I haven't been able to bring myself all day to really have the animus or the ability to really, you know, analyze it, because it was such a great moment. And how could you do nothing but just have fun with that? And frankly, you know, commend Dwayne Wade for the writing of the kid's name on his sneakers and that moment that he provides South Florida. And to me, if you really kind of want to go on a deeper level, those kinds of moments are all the Heat have left to play for, man. And that to me would be, I don't know if it's the negative way of looking at a positive, but so right now the Heat don't have a chance to win a championship. And they don't have really one. They really don't have a chance to win one in the immediate future, because they don't have one of these promising young Embiids, Giannis's, you know, Ben Simmons, Donovan Mitchell, Devin Booker. They don't have one of these players. And so if you're right now sitting in the 8th seed, which the Heat are, and they'll make the playoffs, they'll be between 6 and 8, and you probably lose in the first round to, you know, whether it's Toronto or Boston or whomever. That was your season. That's probably going to be your season, whether or not Dwayne Wade plays a minute or not. And so if that's where we are, you don't really have a young player. So here for me are the sort of the Kobe parameters, right? The Kobe parameters were you're paying him a bunch of money when the Lakers were always going to be a draw, and you couldn't get players to come with him, and he's slowing down the development of young pieces like D'Angelo Russell, who they have to trade. And so you look at the Heat situation, right? They're promising young players. I don't think you can say their ceilings are carry-your-team kind of guys. Josh Richardson, good player, has developed, has been up and down at times this season, but I don't think there's a Heat fan that really looks at Josh Richardson and goes, well, he's gonna be one of the two best guys on a really good team. I just don't think you can say that for a guy who, you know, let's be honest, even though he's fairly new into the league, is still someone who was a four-year college player and is 24 years old right now. So I don't know if you're necessarily thinking at the moment, oh, Josh Richardson, you know, in 3 years' time, he's going to be, you know, among the elites. Is he a future all-star? I don't know, man. Winslow has not proven to be that. The other guys, so you've kind of given away all your cap space. You've locked yourself into a team. And so you kind of look at all these other situations and you go, yeah, I guess. Because the Heat should be trying to chase more moments like that. That's really the only emotional win for their fans that's left this season. I don't think it's winning a playoff series. I don't think it's discovering that brand new player. It's certainly not a first-round pick because they don't have one. And so if I said to you, what's left for a Heat team that isn't going to win the championship this year, isn't going to win the championship in years to come, it's these emotional moments. These really fun games, these really fun situations where Dwayne Wade has the ball at the end of the game, and if he makes the shot, we win. That's what's left. And so, yeah, I guess, go for it. Have fun. You're never going to get me to come on the radio and say I like Hero Ball. I think Hero Ball's awful. I don't like what that was. If you're telling me I can do anything other than get a 21-footer step back around multiple defenders from a guy who's in year 15 in the league and is still a good player offensively, but not one that really should have this kind of carte blanche role, you're never going to get me behind that. But why the hell not?
So, Chris, are you kind of saying that the Heat, they're not going to, you know, make any positive steps forward, you know, having Dwayne Wade on this team? Is that what you're kind
of
saying?
No, yeah, I'm saying towards the future, right?
Yeah, of course, right. At the end of the day, we want to win again, right?
Yeah, exactly. You want to be a championship team, but right now, what path is there to that? It's kind of writing out all these contracts you just got done signing. That's really your path to that is whenever you have cap space next, whenever you have your full allotment of draft picks next. And so as long as this team is going to be middling, which is what they are right now, they're a middling team. They've won, you know, 3 of their last 10 games. You know, they're okay. But if there isn't really any long-term progress to be made, okay. I guess, you know, Dwayne Wade can have his fun. And we can have our fun. Because I do think that there has, and I am the guiltiest of them, and I'm not even someone who enjoys things like this. I like, you know, if I'm rooting for a sports team, I want them to be at least kind of heading towards winning a championship in some way. And so it's not my bag, but I can understand for everyone that went to the arena last night, got your money's worth. You went home and you felt great. If you watch the game on television, you're jumping up and down in your living room. Whatever. You got a ton out of that moment last night. If you're a Heat fan who's followed the 15 years that Dwayne Wade has been in the NBA, that was immense fun. And so, no, the only emotional way to experience sports is not just championship or bust. That's not it. There's, you know, and if it was, then there'd be 28 miserable NBA franchises, and why is their popularity increasing? It's Golden State and Houston. That's it. Maybe Cleveland that can talk themselves into winning the league. And so if that's all there is, then everyone should be miserable. No, there's other things that you can gain. And if it's your team's all-time legend hitting a shot at the end and kind of reinvigorating this image you have of him from previous years, why not?
So, Chris, let me ask you this. In your opinion, if that Dwayne Wade shot doesn't go in, what are we talking about today?
That the team relies on Dwayne Wade too much. that for, I mean, well, and that it, I don't know if it'd be that because he was so good before. It wasn't just like, you know, he was plopped into the game with 6 minutes left to play and just gave him the ball at the end and that's all he did. No, he was terrific in that fourth quarter, the entirety of it.
Well, because he had to be because nobody else was stepping
right,
up. Or
right.
Like Ira said, how many other guys actually took more than two shots besides
right.
Dwayne?
But I think there is a shortage of players on the Heat right now that have the confidence and the kind of, I don't know if reputation is, the pedigree, the reputation, the irrational confidence to say, no, Dwayne, I got this. There's no one on the team that's going to say that to him.
But isn't the point of having an 82 regular season, you know, thing is for players like that that have not had that experience to be able to grow
yeah.
in that moment, you know, and to actually get that in. So if mm-hmm. Dwayne Wade's always taking it, that's fun and great for us because he's been our hero for such a long time. But in some cases, Dwayne Wade's not always going to be here, and we want Dragic, we want Whiteside, we want James Johnson.
Agreed.
We want those guys to be the ones in the moment.
Agreed, but that's the trade-off that the Heat are making. And I don't know how many Heat fans experience that and are going, well, you know, I wish Josh Richardson had the ball so he can figure it out in that situation.
Or
right?
stop fouling guys behind the three-point line in the fourth quarter because
right.
they have a tendency of doing that.
Right, exactly. So I just don't know if you're experiencing the game that way. It's like, give Wade the ball. Let's have some fun. It's not my bag, but I can understand that I'm swimming against the tide there. And that's how people want to experience those games. Continue things. I want to get to some Dolphins at some point because Adam Gase was talking today at the Combine. There's some rumors swirling about the Dolphins potentially trading up to go and get a quarterback in the NFL draft. We'll hear from Adam Gase next and throughout the next hour here on QAM.
Sawgrass.com. This is the Alex Dono Show on South Florida's sports leader. 25 years and counting.
Miami Sports Radio.
And for Dono, my name is Chris Whittingham, here until 10, keeping an eye on the Warriors and the Wizards, and of course, Survivor. In the midst of yet another season premiere, I believe it's 35 for them. Congratulations to Survivor, 35 seasons, that's a lot of seasons. Right now, though, I want to talk to Miami Dolphins, so we do have a presence at the NFL Combine, courtesy of the Big O. He is there with his producer, Alex Solana. They were there today attending the media sessions of Miami Dolphins front office personnel, including Adam Gase, who spoke to the media that was assembled there. Now, there were some reports that circulated earlier in the day involving DraftAnalyst.com's Tony Pauline, who was saying that the Miami Dolphins are potentially using Jarvis Landry as bait to move up in the draft to take a quarterback because they reportedly like Josh Rosen. Now, this is the very important part of the program where we mentioned that during this time of year, there's a lot of smoke screens, a lot of reports that happen, but it is fodder, and he was asked about it. So here is Adam Gase being asked on the idea of him potentially drafting a quarterback.
I'd love to draft a quarterback every year. It doesn't always work out that way. So we'll kind of see how the board falls for us. That first year we felt like Brandon was a guy that there was a lot of us that were very interested to see, what we could do with him, and he had a lot of success in college. So, we're still working through things to try to help him get better, and we'll see how this year goes. It's hard to predict.
Yeah, and Doughty represents Brandon Doughty. He represents the only Dolphins quarterback that they have taken since Adam Gase has been here, and I believe also the only one since Mike Tannenbaum has been here since 2015. So they have not taken any other rookies. It's just a seventh round pick. So they've gone with Tannehill, and that's what Adam Gase says here. Rumors circulating about a first round quarterback. Is Tannehill going to be the starter?
Yeah, Ryan would never shy away from anybody coming in that position. Ryan's going to be our starting quarterback, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. And I can't wait to where we get to get back out there in the spring and get going. And I just know it's going to be really good to have him back.
That is one of the few things that I've noticed about Adam Gase, particularly in locker room settings, in this season when the Dolphins have had other quarterbacks and with a major knee injury, it's very easy for players to kind of get moved out of the consciousness of the coaches, but that's one of the guys that he's been very keen to keep involved is Tannehill. Every game in the locker room, you see him standing there with him on the sidelines during games. He's talking with Tannehill. I think Adam Gase kind of views Ryan Tannehill as the reason why he's here, right? He saw this prospect. He was kind of among the better prospects of, you know, the coaching jobs that were available for Adam Gase when he was a head coaching candidate. And he sees Ryan Tannehill as his guy. And I think it will be interesting to see if the Dolphins do make a move for a quarterback in the first round, because I would always view it as unlikely, given that Ryan Tannehill has always had the approval of Adam Gase, has always had the support of Adam Gase. It would take a pretty significant change of heart for Adam Gase to then endorse a move, because he would have to endorse a move where the Dolphins use an asset to go and get a quarterback earlier in the first round, trade up to go and get one, give up future assets, you'd have to think. And so I don't know if Adam Gase is going to go back on his word. It's why I didn't find the idea of him trading for a quarterback believable. Now, is it possible that Ryan Tannehill at age 30, you can't keep relying on that? You're eventually going to have to find either a replacement or someone down the line to go and take that job, someone to compete with him this season. I would be for it. Like, if you're telling me that Adam Gase really likes one of these five guys that are in the top of the draft right now, who are Josh Rosen, Sam Darnold, Baker Mayfield, Lamar Jackson, and Josh Allen. I haven't said him twice, right? Yeah. So those are the five. If you're telling me Adam Gase really likes one of those guys and wants to go and get him and says to Mike Tannenbaum, go and get him, and then they give up the assets, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a Mahomes situation where you already have Alex Smith, but you kind of know that in the future you're going to go to somebody else, I'd be totally down with that. But based off of the public comments, and not just the comments, the behavior from Adam Gase, I would just find it hard to believe that. You know, I'd find this story hard to believe, where he's basically said, we want to keep Jarvis Landry. We'll play that sound on the next segment. We want to keep Jarvis Landry, and Ryan Tannehill's my guy. And the rumor is you're going to use Landry to move up in the first round to find Tannehill's eventual replacement. It just doesn't add up. Now, it's possible that everyone's lying here, that Adam Gase is lying, but it's been too much from him. From the moment Tannehill was out for the season back in August, it's been nothing but unwavering support. And that's actually the thing that Adam Gase has most signaled since he's been here, is that when he gets a quarterback, Jay Cutler had Adam Gase's unwavering support down to even the final day, giving him the start in that final game and then going to David Fales as his backup and letting him play the rest of the game. He has unwavering support for his quarterbacks. And I think this applies to Ryan Tannehill as well. You'll hear more from Adam Gase from the NFL Combine in Indianapolis. Our friends Alex Solana and Orlando Alzagari efforting that sound. We appreciate them for getting it. We'll play a bit more of it next.
Be at Moore Sawgrass Buick GMC Studios. Morse has more. Visit at MooreSawgrass.com. This is the Alex Dotto Show on Miami Sports Radio 560 WQAM, 96.5 FM HD2, and online at WQAM.com.
And for Donna, my name is Chris Whittingham here on WQAM, here until 10. Coming up over the next couple of nights, we'll have Florida Panthers hockey on the air. I will have this show, though, from 6 until 7, building up to the Florida Panthers game. They play Thursday and Friday at home in the middle of a 6-game homestand. Then they have one game away in Tampa, then another 5-game homestand. They win again last night over the Toronto Maple Leafs in overtime. It's a really good game. There's three really good games in South Florida sports last night. Manny, we departed BB&T Center with 6 minutes to play in the Canes game, and I'm driving home. And, you know, once you kind of immerse yourself in sports all day, I was like, I'll listen to a podcast and maybe I'll get home in time for the finale of the game. And all of a sudden I'm at a stoplight and I get a notification, you know, buzzer beater, Canes win. And I flipped on the station and, you know, Joe Zagacki's already wrapping up. I'm like, no, I missed this. This is an incredible moment in UM basketball, because not only do they get the victory, they win in the Dean Smith Center, which, by the way, an incredible stat that I saw last night. The Miami Hurricanes are now above 500 against Duke and North Carolina in the Jim Larrañaga era. I mean, I tweeted this last night, you know, make him school president. So over the course of this is from Chris Felica, who is known as the Bear on College Game Day for ESPN. He's a UM grad, so he would know. Miami has a winning record against Duke and UNC, 11-9 combined, and a 5-4 mark away from home in Durham and Chapel Hill. They have won 5 of their 9 games that they played there. Here's Joe Zagacki with a call that I missed last night.
Barry for 3 in the tie. Good! 4 seconds to go. He tied the game. Newton has it with 3. Newton lets it fly for the win. It's good! It's good! It's good! Jaquan Newton has won the game. Miami has done it. They have defeated North Carolina at the Dean Smith Center in dramatic fashion. Miami 91, North Carolina 88.
And that's a really good call, because normally the calls that get rewarded in those situations are the ones that are just like, you know, bombast and screaming. And yeah, obviously it's, you know, it's an immense level of energy there, but there's almost like a certain amount of not wanting to shout in the library that you hear like these like almost like kind of hushed tones. It's good. Like it's one of those where it wasn't like I'm going to stand up in the middle of this arena and start yelling because this incredible moment has happened. It's almost like, well, everyone here is going to be pissed off if I really start yelling loudly. So I'm just going to say that it was good. And it was an incredible moment because Jaquan Newton is, you know, if you go to games, he's one of the more derided players actually for UM at the moment. Because he can be a frustrating player at times. Turn the ball over, ill-advised decisions, driving to the basket. It just, you know, every team has to have a frustrating player. And at times for UM fans, it's Jaquan Newton. And as a senior, he dedicated the moment to his mom, who passed away due to breast cancer before he even got to UM. You know, again, a great story. And then you have the Panthers, who in the middle of, you know, this Dwayne Wade moment and in the middle of this UM moment, you know, Doug Plagans provides the commentary for an overtime win.
Backhand cross ice, and this one's picked up by Jared McCann. Full head of steam to the offensive end, McCann in. Shot, he scores! Jared McCann, the winner in overtime. The Panthers win it 3-2.
And that, and by the way, 3-on-3 overtime in hockey is if illicit drugs became sports. It's just absolute madness. It is absolute madness, because the game, you know, devolved in overtime into this series of sprints. You know, Jared McCann cleaning on goal, you know, Maple Leafs cleaning on goal, other Panthers cleaning on goal. It was just absolute mayhem flying both ways, and you just saw Jared McCann go in, and it basically, and not, you know, becomes a shootout, but it's 1v1s, and you have to figure out a way to work around the goaltender. And there you hear Jared McCann getting the winner. So they've won 3 in a row. They're 5 points off of the Columbus Blue Jackets for the final wild card position in the Eastern Conference. I have not yet done my scoreboard watching this evening in terms of the games that I have to watch. The thing for the Panthers, though, is that so right now their advantage over the rest of the league is they've played fewer games than everybody else. And so they have that ability to make those points that they don't have up because they have, you know, these extra games that they have left to play. The problem is that you're constantly playing catch-up. You constantly have to win in order to make up that difference. So you'd prefer that Columbus start to lose a little bit. They're at Los Angeles tomorrow night, and then they're at Anaheim, at San Jose. So the weekend is kind of this West Coast swing through Los Angeles and San Jose. You go into Orange County a little bit to take on the Ducks. So that is where the Panthers sit at the moment in terms of the playoff chase. The Panthers themselves have a back-to-back coming up over the next couple of games. They're going to try and overtake Carolina and the New York Islanders if they were able to win these games. They take on New Jersey tomorrow night at BB&T Center. If you want to get your tickets, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday are when the Panthers play at home. So home New Jersey, then home Buffalo, one of the worst teams in the league. And then they take on the Philadelphia Flyers, who are right now in a playoff place in the Eastern Conference. They are second in the Metropolitan Conference. So that'll be Sunday, 3 p.m. from BB&T Center. So a little bit of an earlier start time there. And so that right now is the Panthers situation. And so they're going to try and continue to go on the chase to go and get one of these wild card positions, and it'll be fun to watch them try. Let's go back to the Dolphins, though, because you're talking about this in the previous segment when it came to Ryan Tannehill. Here's Jarvis Landry. Obviously, the Dolphins slapped the franchise tag on Jarvis Landry. Here is Adam Gase on what the status of that situation is going forward.
Yeah, that's really, you know, that's Mike and Chris's. That's Mike and Chris kind of handle that stuff. I stay out of that. And, you know, we got time for everything. We're not going to get in a big rush just because everybody wants to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, and that's something that the Dolphins have had a long time to figure out. And it's kind of amazing to me that it's even gotten to this point. Just because you have this player, you drafted him, you knew entering last season, one of the most underpaid players in the league. For his production, he gave you 100 catches a season at basically something, you know, a little bit short of $800,000 a season. That's nothing. That's nothing.
But as O would say, yeah, he has eight over, what was it? He has a lot of catches, but each catch worth what, 5-6 yards?
Yeah, no, I think his yards per catch this season was a little under 9, which was lowest in the league.
But amongst he's still anyone caught the ball.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, he's an important part of their offense. You can't say that. And in the short passing game NFL, you can say Jarvis Landry has a valuable skill set because he's very often asked to do things that are difficult. He's given the ball, you know, behind the line of scrimmage and then, you know, asked to, you know, break tackles to go and get the 6 yards, which if you say, oh, you're averaging 6 yards a catch, that's not good. But sometimes 6 yards is good given a situation. So I just... There are times with the Dolphins, though. It happened with Lamar Miller. It happened with Olivier Vernon, where if you just get out ahead of these things, if you're not to me, the thing that the Dolphins constantly do is put themselves in salary cap positions where they can't make those long-term commitments. And then when they do, they make them to Andre Branch and Kenny Stills or Kiko Alonso. Those aren't the players that you're meant to be doing that with. You're signing, you know, free agents to these kinds of contracts. No, you're giving them guaranteed dollars where this year they can't even cut those guys. They can cut them next year, but you can't even cut those guys because you've given them all this guaranteed money. That guaranteed money should be going to Dolphins draft picks, not the Dolphins free agents or trades, I don't think.
Do you think that Sue contract has anything to do with it?
Oh, absolutely. The Sue contract is going to be... I would say next year is the last year where you can finally, you know, get out from underneath it. But the thing that the Dolphins are thinking about doing is adding more guarantees to next year to reduce the number for this year. And every year this has happened with the Sue contract. Every single year, can you take a, you know, we'll give you some more guarantees, but, you know, we want to shave a little bit off the cap now. That's the entire time with the Sue contract. And that was meant to be, well, Sue is a large chunk of your defense, not just that one position, but his impact is meant to help the entire defense, and that hasn't happened. You haven't seen a pass rush manifest itself just because Sue is there, or a run defense emerge just because Sue is there. There's more to it. And so that would be my only complaint with the Landry thing. Here's Adam Gase, by the way, on what his communication is like with Jarvis.
Have you talked to Jarvis at all personally?
I have not since the end of the season. Yeah, I mean, anytime, you guys know this about me, anytime I have a conversation with a player, you know, that's going to stay private. I'm not going to talk about anything publicly.
And so he says that he hasn't talked with Jarvis since the last day of the season. And it really has typified a relationship that you have to say at this point has kind of soured. The relationship between the Dolphins and Jarvis Landry is not good. Between all the verbal, all the subtweeting that's happened on social media, all these kind of mixed messages, all these things that have happened. And then players hate the franchise tag, man. When you're a free agent, you're, you know, particularly for a player like Jarvis Landry entering year 5, that's the peak of an NFL player's value. His second contract, an NFL player's second contract is the most important thing to an NFL player because who the hell knows? Jarvis Landry might not see another contract. He wants to get as many guaranteed dollars now as possible. And so the franchise tag is hated by every NFL player. They hate going on the franchise tag, even though you're basically saying, you know, we'll give you this, you know, pretty significant amount of money now. It's more about securing guarantees in the long term. And so Jarvis Landry right now is kind of in this hell where he either takes a Dolphins offer that he might not want to take or serve out the rest of the season, but really grumpy. Maybe you go through a holdout. You don't see holdouts, you know, contractual holdouts, but Le'Veon Bell took a contractual holdout because of getting the franchise tag last year with Pittsburgh. And so it's entirely possible that Jarvis Landry, we're in a holdout situation. So you're kind of in this, you know, in this holding pattern with what do you do? And so you maybe try to make a little bit of a stink. We've seen his agent make these public comments that, you know, he thinks that his client's Antonio Brown level in terms of the money that he should be making. You know, there's all these different kinds of combating wars of words. That's not a good work environment. And so the relationship between the Dolphins and Jarvis Landry is frayed. And unless they're prepared to, frankly, overpay in order to keep him, to give him this long-term contract that he probably wants, I'm not sure how that gets fixed. And Jarvis Landry, yeah, I'd give him credit. He put on a good face for most of the year in terms of, all right, you know, I have to be a leader on the team. I got to, you know, do this and do that. But you probably know that privately he was seething, that he didn't get this deal before the season started. So he knows, okay, my organization believes in me. For a guy that's always looking on chips on his shoulder, he got a pretty clear message from this organization that, we're not so sure about you.
Well, if you kind of remember the last game of the season, too, I mean, he had a little bit of a scuffle there.
Yeah, with Buffalo, yeah.
Not, you know, like, you never really heard the coaches, you know, not really have his back, but really say, oh, no, you know, it was just a freak accident or nothing. They basically never really said much.
Yeah.
So you include everything that's been going on and where I'm pretty sure his agent's been wanting to talk, has been waiting to talk, and yet there's no communication. And for, you know, the head coach of the football team to say, well, I haven't spoken to him till since the end of the year, you know, I get it. Coaches coach players, you know what I mean? And, of course, we leave everything else, you know, in the upstairs realm for them to deal with contracts. But, man, if a coach is telling the media he hasn't spoken to a player, you know, that kind of doesn't sense like a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, you'd imagine that Adam Gase is talking with other players.
Absolutely. Right, because he wants to know what's going on for this offseason, what's going on for next year. Because guess what? You know, there's a job to be done. But for him to say, I haven't spoken to Landry since the end of last year, that doesn't spell, you know, good beans.
And he he's someone that seems to value these interpersonal relationships. He values locker room stuff in a way that, you know, obviously Joe Philbin wouldn't. I don't know if Joe Philbin's texting his players. He doesn't seem like he was much of a relationship builder with his players.
Well, he definitely didn't text Michael Agnew.
Agnew, you were terrible. I'll never forget. That's one of the great Hard Knocks clips of all time.
Michael Agnew, where you at? Michael
Agnew. Agnew, where were you? You were terrible.
Sherman, right?
Yeah, Mike Sherman, yeah. If you put that kind of stuff on film, be looking for tight ends. Oh, man, such a great Hard Knocks scene. One of the greats. Just shows how different the NFL work environment is. Want to get to a couple of NFL other related things. So they are right now, the competition committee is meeting, and I'm not sure there's a job in sports I'd want more. Have influence on the rules, changes we can make. So the big one, though, the big two at the moment, are the catch rule, which the NFL owners and the competition committee are discussing. Now, here's what's going on. This is courtesy of a report from ESPN. The NFL Competition Committee has reached a unanimous agreement that some of the league's most debated catch controversies should have been ruled complete, according to committee member and New York Giants owner John Mara. This includes Dallas Cowboys receiver Dez Bryant in the 2014 playoffs, Detroit Lions receiver Calvin Johnson in the 2010 season, and it has prompted a discussion during meetings at the scouting combine geared towards rewriting the rule for the 2018 season. I think where we are unanimous are that plays like the Dez Bryant one in Green Bay and the Calvin Johnson one a couple of years ago, all of us agree that those should be completions. So let's write language to make the to make them completions. That's where it gets difficult, is in the legalese, right? Because the legalese are what all the fans are going to hold up when we go to instant replay and it's either for your team or against your team. Oh, no, but it has to meet with these rules. Now, by the way, he did say that there was less consensus about the Jesse James touchdown or the it was overruled. Like, yeah, it ended up being a fumble that ended up ending the game. There ended up being less consensus about that there were, like, you know, the entire room watched and they weren't sure if that was a catch. So even within things that I think a lot of people view to be universal, I don't think that it's as universal as people think. I think if we had, like, let's say, I always thought that the rule should be you have like a control group, like a focus group. You have a focus group of NFL fans that have been watching NFL football their entire life, and you give them a buzzer, yes or no, a green button or a red button, catch or no catch, and they decide. Right, and
I hope this panel doesn't include Patriot fans.
it's a combination of every fan in the country. So it's like the U.S. Senate. You get three representatives on this panel. And so you hit the green button. And it's basically, it's just, I've watched football. I know what a catch is, right? Because if you have this panel and you put the Dez Bryant play in front of them, that's a catch. The Jesse James one, it's a catch. Like, you know, all these sort of convoluted rulings, if you just kind of put them in the hands of average Joes, I mean, they know the answer is. The problem is when you get to needing to sort out, like, because it's what the statement says. They have to rewrite the rule to sort of fit in that juxtaposition. And so you can't just say, well, we know it's not the Supreme Court definition of porn. I know it when I see it. It's not, you can't just say, well, we know what a catch is and we'll just tell you. No, you have to describe if the player has the ball with 2 feet down and has possession of the ball, then it's a catch. Well, what about if he's going to ground? What about this whole football move thing that they created? Fans love throwing around the football move thing, right? So what actually counts in the legalese? How do they write it so that these things don't happen? They can figure it out, but that's a tough one. The other one that they're debating is the pass interference rule. Now, they are considering a move to the college football pass interference rule, which is if it's a pass 1 yard downfield or 80 yards downfield, well, okay, if it's 15 yards downfield or 80 yards downfield, it's the same penalty, which is 15 yards. Getting rid of the spot of the foul element of pass interference. That's a tough one for me. I've always thought that we can find the gray area in between these two things. And I understand you're putting more in the hands of referees, which I'm not sure most people would be down with. But I think you could have intentional pass interference, which is you tackle a guy so that he doesn't, you know, catch the deep bomb. Or you armbar him, you drag him to the ground, or whatever. It's blatant, right? That we can do spot fouls for. Because if you're basically the reason why the college rule can be bad is if you throw a Hail Mary down the field, you have every incentive to just tackle a guy, and then the other team gains 15 yards, and then they try it again. Kind of like how at the end of games you'll see, you know, on 2-point conversions that another team has to get. We had that with the Raiders and the Chiefs this year. Remember that on Thursday Night Football where there was like 6 pass interferences because it's a 2-point conversion. I'm just going to wait for you to throw the ball out of bounds. I'll just keep taking interference penalties. That'll be what ends up happening on these kind of, you know, deep bombs. And so I think there can be a gray area where it's intentional versus, incidental, if you want to call it that. So that, okay, if a DB and a receiver's feet come together and they didn't mean to 70 yards downfield, it's not a 70-yard penalty. But if you tackle him, it's a 70-yard penalty. That would be my solution. But it seems like the NFL is thinking about going to the college interference rule. So who knows?
Well, what the language be then, if you want that rule to happen?
It would be like, like blatant interference or use of force to stop a player. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, so
exactly. You would use words that you know people my age and our ages will come to understand.
Right, exactly.
There's fans that, including me, I read the rule book and I'm like, what is this?
Yeah, dude? Exactly.
Like, please, like,
right.
Your average fan base knows from here to here, and you're trying to explain this to a person that probably knows the Constitution of every word of the USA. We don't know that.
It created the need for Mike Pereira to exist. Mike Pereira has to exist because these rules have so much language that it makes no sense. And so you need these guys that, like, it literally almost has to withstand, you know, judicial criticism, right? Be like, if we tried this rule in a court of law, would this stand up? And so I think that might be a bit exciting. You have David, you said, on line 5? David, you're on QAM. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. Kind of along the same lines with the penalties for football, it's crazy that if you're inside your own 5-yard line, backed up against the goal, and you get, let's say, a holding call, well, they only back you up like 2.5 feet or less.
Yeah.
So it's not really a fair penalty.
There are ones where if you intentionally take holding in the end zone, that's a safety.
Well, right, but I mean, theoretically, you could hold 4 times and.
Right.
Keep backing up.
But,
I mean, I think what they should do is, in that scenario, instead of backing you up 1.5 feet, extend the first down marker.
Oh, that's a good idea. I like this idea.
True 10-yard penalty.
Okay, I mean, so instead of it being like first and 12, it's first and 20.
Right, like it'd be a true 10-yard holding call.
I like this idea. We're going to submit this to the competition committee. That's good stuff. I like that. Like half the distance to the goal. How do you fix half the distance to the goal? That's good. I like any and all idea. I'm here for ideas, right? So, you know, Manny Chang didn't like my buzzer idea for figuring out what a catch is.
No. He was shaking his head. I don't like the idea. I just don't trust that certain fan bases that won't be, you know, very honest.
You
have a panel of Patriot fans over here,
right?
And then you have Brown fans. Like, well, unfortunately, maybe, I would trust Brown fans more because they've been through more heck.
Yeah, exactly.
Than Patriot
fans. Well, you'd certainly have to take the fans that like out of the conflict of interest games. You couldn't have like Patriots fans ruling on a team within the division. I don't know. Either way, to me, a panel of non-referees, of just knowledgeable football fans that know what a catch is, and they decide a or nay.
Let's have Snoop Dogg, Peter King, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get Peter King in a room with his MMQB staff, and they figure out what a catch is. Not Mike Pereira and his team.
Dean Blandino, when you actually text him a good question, and he never really replies to it.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. Like, you put him on television, and it's...
No, and then you Snapchat a picture of it, and you show it to him. Like, I think it was the Bills and the Patriots.
Yeah.
This is clearly not a catch. To me, Benjamin caught it in the end zone, and the ball got knocked out, and they said incomplete.
Yeah.
And I even showed him and everything, and he wrote back to me, ... I don't know what that means in the NFL terms.
That means, I don't know. That means let's shrug our shoulders. But that's the thing, is that the reason why this hit a critical mass is it happened during the Super Bowl. And Chris Collinsworth's on television going, I don't know. I'm not even going to try and guess.
3-4 steps.
Yeah.
Oh, they have to overrule this. But, are you kidding me?
But, I mean, he goes to ground and, you know, the ball looks like it was squeezing out. That's the thing, is that it's been put in our minds. If you go to ground and you lose control, then it's not a catch.
Chris, if that would have not counted, I might not be here.
You'd burn something down. Chris, what do you got in for Dono on QAM?
Murder on my mind, it's time to pray to God. My revolver's not religious, the revolution's born. You wanna know my name, then go and tell us all.
Chris Whittingham in for Alex Dono here on WQAM, here until 10. You'll hear CBS Sports Radio at that point. In the next segment, get to a couple of soccer news items. Manny and I, both soccer fans. We have a World Cup situation, a U.S. hosting situation, and we have a Neymar injury to discuss.
Good news for me.
That's right, exactly. Real Madrid support on the other side, so we'll get to that coming up next. Right now, though, I wanted to talk about yesterday on the show, which was from 6 to 7 from BB&T Center, I was railing against tanking in the NBA and how the NBA absolutely needs to do something, and this is ridiculous already, and we have another situation tonight in the NBA where I'll just go ahead and tell you right now what the results are going to be in certain games, just based off of looking at the records of the teams involved. Although one of them, I'm going to be wrong about. The Atlanta Hawks are 93-78 up on the Indiana Pacers. The Pacers lost to the tanking Mavs the other night. The Pacers are the elixirs for tanking. The Hawks are going to go and win. They're 18-43. They're making a grave mistake. Take a palooza tonight in Memphis as the Phoenix Suns take on the Memphis Grizzlies. Suns 18-44, Grizzlies 18-41. Right now the Suns are up by 4. Again, making a terrible mistake. Well, you look at their starting 5. I think all of their starters are top 10 picks. They have Elfrid Payton, Devin Booker, Josh Jackson, Dragan Bender, and Alex Len. That's a really young team, by the way. So they're on top right now of Memphis, who, if I said to you, like, Manny Chang, can you name the 5 starters for the Memphis Grizzlies?
The Memphis Grizzlies. Okay, Conley, Vince Carter, Gasol.
Okay, so Conley's out for the season with an injury. Vince Carter's in Sacramento. Other than that, good start.
Zach Randolph?
No, he's also in Sacramento.
He's left too? Oh, Peja Stojakovic.
Come on, Peja Stojakovic. So here's their starting 5. Ben McLemore, Andrew Harrison, Dylan Brooks, Jamichael Green, and Marc Gasol. It's their starting 5. Because Conley is out for the season, And obviously they fired David Fizdale, and they've only gone downhill from there. The other team that I can tell you for a fact is going to lose tonight, well, one already did, where the Orlando Magic lost 117-104 to the Toronto Raptors. They're tanking well. The Oklahoma City Thunder will take care as well of the Dallas Mavericks. The only one who had gotten wrong tonight was the Atlanta Hawks, who were surprising everyone by winning last night in terms of tankapalooza. The Hornets beat the Bulls, no surprise there. The Cavs beat the Nets. The Nets are giving away their pick to Cleveland, so Cleveland had extra incentive to go and beat them. Well, that game, I think, went to the wire. Portland easily took care of Sacramento. So you basically have, every night, a game where you can look, you know, two or three games, because you have eight tanking teams right now, where you can say, all right, I know for a fact that they're going to try and lose. So, Adam Silver has put out a memo. He's going to fix this by memo. Now, he did fine Mark Cuban a very substantial amount of money because Mark Cuban was extolling the virtues of tanking. He was basically saying, oh yeah, no, it's a strategy, it makes sense. So here's what the NBA and their commissioner, Adam Silver, has put out via a statement. Over the past several seasons, discussions about so-called tanking in the NBA have occurred with some frequency, both in the public discourse and within our league. And U.S. governors have taken steps to address the underlying incentive issues by adopting changes to our draft lottery system that will go into effect next year. Those changes, instead of basically getting extra, they're described as ping pong balls. That's not how it works. You get extra combinations of the lottery balls. You know, it's 0 through 10, and there's like 1,001 combinations, and you get kind of, you know, a proportional amount based off of how far down the standings you finished. And so you get 25% right now of those combinations if you have the worst record in the league. What the change is going to be that 1, 2, and 3, the bottom three finishers are all going to have an even chance of winning the lottery. So it's some changes, but right now you have an 8-team tanking race. And so if you're an eighth, you're going to try and get into the three. It doesn't make that much of a difference. You're going from, okay, maybe you're not going to try and be the worst team in the league, but you're going to try and be one of the three worst teams in the league because those are the teams that have the best lottery odds. And so, yeah, those changes are going to go into effect next year. Are they going to make that big of a difference? I don't know. The statement goes on. Throughout this period, we have been careful to distinguish between efforts teams may make to rebuild their rosters, including through personnel changes over the course of several seasons, and circumstances in which players or coaches on the floor take steps to lose games. The former can be a legitimate strategy to construct a successful team within the confines of league rules. The latter, which we have not found and hope never to see in the NBA, has no place in our game. If we ever received evidence that players or coaches were attempting to lose or otherwise taking steps to cause any game result to otherwise than on its competitive merits, that conduct would be met with the swiftest and harshest response possible from the league office.
Sounds like David Stern wrote that.
Well, yeah, I mean, he certainly would have language that strong. I would just like to present to the NBA league office a box score. I don't know if you remember this. This was... What year did Justice Winslow get drafted?
3 years ago?
15?
15?
Yeah. Do you remember the final game of the 2014-15 Miami Heat season?
I do not.
They played in Philly. And that was a terrible, terrible Philadelphia 76ers team.
And the Heat lost.
And the Heat lost. But it is the manner in which they lost that I would submit... If they are going to be raining down... actually, you know what? I'm sorry. They won that night. That is entirely my fault because the Sixers are even worse. So here's what happens, right? So the Miami Heat on that night, they won 105-101. They were competing with Brooklyn because remember, you'll recall that the Heat had a top 10 protected pick that year. And so they needed to be 10. And there was kind of a fight between them and Brooklyn as to who would be 10 or 11. Now, it turns out that night that Brooklyn won, so it made the Heat result moot. But if the Heat had won and Brooklyn had lost, Miami would have been 11 and would have needed to jump all the way into the top three in order to keep their first-round pick. But they got lucky, Brooklyn won, and Miami won. Here's how they won. Would you like to take a guess at the minutes distribution for the players that started that night? That night starting for the Heat, Zoran Dragic, Tyler Johnson, James Ennis, Henry Walker, and Michael Beasley. the starting five that evening for the Miami Heat. The minutes distribution. There was only one sub into the game. Udonis Haslam came in for Zoran Dragic for 7 minutes because Zoran Dragic was in foul trouble and was otherwise terrible. Otherwise, Michael Beasley, Henry Walker, James Ennis, and Tyler Johnson all played 48 minutes against the Philadelphia 76ers in a 105-101 victory that was blatant tanking. Just the most obvious tanking. And it was, and I was listening to a pantheon of like greatest tanking examples in the history of the NBA. And I was stunned that this game wasn't brought up. They played four guys, including Henry Walker, 48 minutes.
Who hasn't seen the court since?
Right. He hasn't played an NBA game since. And it was a damn miracle he was playing in the NBA then.
And I think that was the most minutes James Ennis has ever played in a Heat
uniform. I mean, it has to be. Michael Beasley, 48 minutes, 12 of 27 from the field. He had 34 points that night. 34 for Beasley. And they made the mistake of winning against a Philadelphia 76ers team that finished 18-64. And so the teams do this. And it is in their best interest to do this. The NBA cannot get out of this by scolding their teams. It's not going to work. There's too much benefit. I'm watching Golden State right now. They tanked to get Harrison Barnes, blatantly, in the middle of their rebuild with Curry and with Klay Thompson.
Mavs are done 11, by the way.
Right. I mean, you can't fix this by scolding. There's no amount of public embarrassment. There's no amount of shame that's going to get teams to fix this. It's the only reason why the Philadelphia 76ers had their front office executive removed, because they were brazen about it. They told you what they were doing. They called it the process. And so, yeah, there's no amount of, you know, public comments. It's changing the incentive structure of the league. It's the only way this changes. It is the only way. And we talked about this with Ira Winderman, who was kind enough to join us earlier, where you're kind of looking around the standings tonight and you don't know, you know, let's say you're the Heat right now. And you're following the progress of Detroit. Now, they're not playing a tanking team tonight. They beat the Bucks 110-87. And so the Pistons are going to, you know, are trying to climb up the standings to catch Miami in that ninth playoff spot. But you don't know. So you're following Detroit. And then the teams above you, you're trying to get, you know, the seeding advantage on. You're trying to catch up on Indiana, Philly, Milwaukee, and Washington. Because those are the teams that, in terms of the loss column, are in that general area. Now, the Pacers are playing a tanking team tonight, and as I mentioned, are losing. And so, you know, that does help in a certain respect. But on a given night, if they're playing Orlando, if they're playing the Phoenix Suns, if they're playing Memphis, if they're playing the Knicks, if they're playing all these teams that are the Sacramento Kings, all these teams that are down at the bottom of the league, you're like, oh, they're going to get a win tonight. It doesn't matter. Like, there's no sense even watching it. And for that to be the case with a month and a half left to play in the season, it's a travesty. It's a travesty.
I think I have an idea.
Well, okay. You know I like ideas. Do we tease it?
Go ahead.
Manny's idea for fixing tanking is next.
I really should. She said she don't.
Chris Whittingham in for Dono here on WQAM. One more segment. We'll be off to CBS Sports Radio. I'm watching a soccer match right now from CONCACAF Champions League, which is it's FC Dallas right now. They're taking on a team from, I believe it's Honduras, called Tauro. And so there is a goal kick, and the Honduran team is right now winning on aggregate over the U.S. team. And the goalkeeper went to take a goal kick and appeared to trip over an advertisement. So in the middle of time wasting, there's like this kind of weird font that has popped up from in behind the goal, and it seems like he tripped over it on purpose. Just a lovely bit of time wasting. That just happens sometimes in the world of football. Well, we'll get to that in a matter of moments. First, though, there was a texter that wrote in saying we have not provided enough ideas to fix the NBA's tanking problem. Now, I'm not going to blame you for not listening to the show around 6:30 last night. You know, you're just driving around, you're listening to the show. So I'll offer my ideas again. Number one, the easiest one, flatten the lottery odds. If you don't make the playoffs, you have just as good a chance to get the number one pick as the team with the worst record in the league. So you don't have any tanking because there's no benefit to tanking. So everyone's going to try and compete for the playoffs. That, for me, is the easiest way. Stop rewarding losing in any context. Number two, you eliminate the draft. There's no more draft. And players that are coming out of college, although college basketball is going to end soon, and so you just have an NBA academy, that for me would actually fix the problem, because you could just sign younger players when they're 15 or whatever and bring them through your academy, and then you can sign into pro contracts. That could be one way of doing it. Or you have whatever youth development system you put in place, and they can come into the league with a 20% max. So right now, the way that the maximum salaries work is that after your rookie contract, you can make 25% of the salary cap as a max salary. In your third contract, you can make 30%, and in your fourth contract, you can make 35%. I'm oversimplifying, but that's basically how it works. So what if you had a 20% max, and you basically allowed rookies to enter free agency? That would mean that the teams that are best probably wouldn't have the salary cap to go and bring in a high-level rookie, so they wouldn't necessarily be going to the best teams. They have some, you know, decision over where they want to go, which I think is always better. The small market still have a chance, because if you have cap space and you can offer the max, you present at least a desirable offer to one of these rookies that would be available. And so that, for me, is another way to do it. In terms of if you want to keep a lottery system, maybe make the top 10 even odds or something like that. I just think, or maybe you have a single elimination tournament to determine who gets the number one pick of the teams that don't make the playoffs. You have like a 14-team tournament of the teams that don't make the playoffs, and the winner gets the number one pick. I've seen that thrown around. I don't know. That's my man. You said you had an idea, though. What's your idea?
Well, to make it less complicated as it pertains to next year's rule changes, the bottom three teams that have an equal amount of getting the first overall pick, you give them an extra amount of cash in the cap room, and they have to spend it on getting better players. If they do not spend the max that they give them, they give up picks in the draft.
Wow. I like that.
Because then those extra picks, they can't use them. Okay, well, if we give you this player, we'll give you a conditional pick for next year. No. Those three teams that have a chance to get the first overall, you get an extra amount of extra cap. Mm-hmm. You go out there. You get players. You have to reach a certain amount. If you do not reach a certain amount, they take away picks in the next season or in the year after that or whatever the case may be.
I like that idea. That's a good, maybe add like, you know, extra $5 million or $6 million you get kind of in salary cap to go and sign. And the players union would go for that because they're always looking for opportunities for veteran players, because that's the majority of their union, is they want veteran players to come into the league and have opportunities and stay in the league. So I'd absolutely be down for that. So, to me, there's any number of ways that the NBA can go about fixing this. I don't think they try hard enough.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.